I'm Greg Johnson. Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. I'm here in London with Richard Edmonds, who is a longtime activist in the British national scene. Richard, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Greg. I appreciate the opportunity to speak to your listeners and to be on your show.
Give us an introduction to yourself, how you got involved in nationalism, a bit about your career.
Okay. I was born in the middle of the Second World War. So I was born in 1943. That has a big effect on me. My father was in the Second World War. He had the good fortune to survive that war. My mother's brother was killed in it, and I was brought up as a child, hearing my mother forever saying, "What good did the brother's death do?" And she'd answer bitterly, "No good whatsoever." That's my sort of family background. My parents were what I think you would call blue-collar workers. My father worked for the underground. It was an ordinary, humble British family, very decent people. I owe my parents a lot. I had a very happy childhood. So I was born in 43. That's a bit important, that date, because when I was 16, which is we're now talking 1959, that's when the coloured stir first started coming into Britain, the late 50s. And we were a working-class family living in West London, and we started seeing these what I might call exotics from the tropics in our local high street. These were Sikhs with turbans, and they were utterly un-British and utterly didn't fit into our way of life. So, and I tell you that my parents thought, well, what's going on here? Who are these people? What are they doing in our country? And it wasn't just my parents. There was a general feeling that there was something wrong with this immigration from the Third World, because in the 1950s, the experience of the British people, they knew all about the colour problems in the United States of America. They knew about the race riots that had taken place during the Second World War in cities like Detroit, when I think 10 million young Americans, white men, were drafted into your armed forces in the Second World War. And of course, there was a tremendous labor shortage in those northern industries. They needed manpower to make all the armaments which were, you know, needed for the Second World War. And we knew in Britain that there had been serious race riots in Detroit, for a start, where people were killed as blacks killed whites and whites killed blacks. And people did not want that in Britain. In addition, you must remember that Britain had had an empire. And our empire was based upon the, well, when we had an empire, the coloureds were not permitted into Britain. That's a fact. When I was a child, Britain was 100% white, 100% white, 100% white. And the coloureds were not allowed into this country. But at the same time, because the British people knew what their empire was like, and because particularly the Second World War, when millions of British soldiers had been moved all around the world, we knew of the problems that existed in the British Empire. The British Empire, of course, consisted of two halves. There were the white dominions, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and the white parts of Southern Africa. But there was also the coloured world of India. When the British gave independence to India in 1948, there were massive race riots, massive religious riots, as in villages between the Hindus and the Muslims. Over 1 million people were murdered in India when British law and order was removed from that country, when British soldiers, British magistrates, British judges, along with British engineers, British doctors and British nurses, British railway engineers, when they were removed from India in 1948, there was race riots, religious riots between the Hindus and the Muslims. And in a village where, say, 10% of the population was Muslim and 90% was Hindu, or the other way round, 10% Hindu, 90% Muslim, they slaughtered each other. 1 million victims fell to that. And so people in Britain knew all about those problems. In addition, we knew of the apartheid problems in South Africa, because, you know, that had been part of our empire. We knew of the problems, the black, white, and indeed Indian problems in South Africa. I don't know if you know this, but during the Second World War, the Indians of Durban were slaughtered by the Zulus. It's just one of the little incidences. So we did not want these problems imported into Britain. And there was tremendous opposition to this amongst British people. And the British establishment in its utter wickedness, they dealt with this opposition by two ways. Well, one way, if you like. We were working class. Our working class newspaper in those days happened to be the Daily Mirror. I wouldn't look at the Daily Mirror now. It was a rather more serious paper than the Rag has developed. You didn't have the Sun either. You had a working class paper, which working class people took as their Bible, the Daily Mirror. And the Daily Mirror assured us, because we had that in our house, and the Daily Mirror assured us, you know, the working class people of Britain, work for London Underground or whatever, digging coal out of coal mines, they assured us, the immigrants are here for a short time. They are students. They are apprentices. They've come here for a short time. And because we're a generous people, and because we were used to running an empire and have a rather paternalistic attitude towards these coloureds, we accepted them on the basis that they would be here for a short time. The Daily Mirror notoriously assured its readers, they're only here for a short time, they're not going to stay, they're not going to colonise us, they're here for a short time. And on that basis, they were accepted. At the same time, that was how the socialists, the Labour Party, the Daily Mirror, dealt with its working class constituents. Don't worry, they're here for a short time. The Conservatives, there was a key general election in 1959. Now, that might be half a century ago, which it is, but I was 16 at the time, and these things are burnt into my mind, because I saw my world changing, and I discussed it with my parents. What does it all mean? So in 1959, there was a general election, and the Prime Minister at the time, called Harold Macmillan, wanted to get himself re-elected as Prime Minister. So for the first time, and we've seen it in every election since, the Tories, the Conservatives, played the race card. They assured the British people, vote for us in 1959, and we will stop immigration. We will stop it. And we were so naive, we thought it was going to stop. Harold Macmillan won a tremendous majority, sweeping majority, swept the country on the promise that immigration would stop. Well, that was 50 years ago. And I'll tell you, every election that the Tories have won, they've won by playing the race card. Maggie Thatcher got herself elected in 79 by playing the race card. She went on the television and said, "We Conservatives understand the fears of the British people of being swamped by alien cultures." Yeah. They know all about alien cultures, and yeah, they know how to play the race card. She got herself elected with a massive majority. Now, so all this is taking place. So in 59, we thought it was over. And because, 59, I was what, 16. Come 18, 19, because I was adventurous, I went and emigrated to Australia, right? And my parents didn't want me to. My mother cried at the airport because she was, you know, I was her only son. Anyway, off I went to Australia because I wanted to. Yeah. I lived there several years. I didn't get married, so I just eventually come back to Britain. When I came back to Britain, of course, I had the picture in my mind of what Britain was like when I left it in, whenever it was, 61 or 62. I come back 3 years later, and I can see that the coloureds are now getting a grip on this country. When I left Britain at the age of 18, I actually felt, what's the word? Indulgent, liberal towards them. They didn't bother me in the least. I thought they were here as students, apprentices. They didn't bother me. They're not in the least. But when I came back, I saw they were getting a grip. That they were staying here and putting down roots. And I thought, I discussed it with my father. I said, you know, there's something wrong here. Anyway, you know, one has a life. As it happens, a year or two later, against my father's wishes, I then emigrated to Canada and lived in Canada for some time. He said to me, "What do you want to go there for, son?" I said, "Because I want to." Completely unanswerable. So off I went. Yeah. So I stayed in Canada, went all around the US and came back to Britain. Then I went to college and started studying seriously, which up to then I hadn't really done so. Anyway, then came another crucial event in the history of British nationalism. A very, very brave man called Enoch Powell made a speech in 1968. He sort of warned the British people. I'll describe to your listeners here. Enoch Powell was rather like your Pat Buchanan. He was a conservative. He wasn't, strictly speaking, a white realist or a race realist or a white nationalist at all. He was an old, classical, real conservative, rather like Pat Buchanan is. And Powell made a speech in 1968 in which he said, because understand, Powell had served in the British Army. He had served in India. He was a very educated man. He was a professor in Greek and Latin. he had had a very good job at the University of, I'm speaking about Enoch Powell because he's very important to British nationalism and to me personally, and to my generation. Powell, I think, was one of the youngest professors of Greek and Latin. He went over and had a good job in Australia. The day that war broke out, he resigned his position as a professor in Australia. He could have stayed there. He could easily be, you know, lived the war out in Australia as a professor. He came back to Britain, joined the army as a British private, you know, an ordinary soldier. Because he was so educated and talented, he worked his way up and became an officer. And he was based in India for quite some years. In fact, at one time, I think he was fluent in Hindi since he would mastered Greek and Latin. I don't suppose Hindi would have been too difficult for him since it's also an Indo-European language. Yeah. Anyway, he was a member of parliament in our West Midlands, one of the first areas to get really damaged by all this immigration. So Powell made his speech and he said, oh, it absolutely electrified the British people. He said, we must be mad, literally mad, letting all these aliens into our country. They have nothing to do with us. They've got their own countries. They're all independent. Their culture is utterly different from ours. They're racially different from ours, from us. This country, Britain, is piling up its funeral pyre by letting all this immigration take place. Now, Powell happened to be a member of the Conservative Party, but he electrified the socialist Labour working class as much as the Tories. He spoke as a patriot, but the working class in Britain is very patriotic, and he set them alight with his words. And my father, who was a working class man, and up to that date had always voted Labour, but a very shrewd man, my father, said to me, Richard, he said, if the Tories, the Conservative Party, don't expel Enoch Powell, if they don't throw him out, I'll vote Tory for the first time in my life, which was a big step for him politically. Anyway, my father was shrewd. The Tories threw Enoch Powell into the wilderness, just threw him away, and threw away the British people, actually. Revealed themselves having hearts of stone. I don't know who the Tories take their orders from, but they certainly don't listen to the British people. Right. That's another question, of course, who their masters might be. Anyway, that had a tremendous effect. So that was in 68. I happened to be at college at the time. Southampton University, actually, a very fine university. I study engineering. And what appalled me was that the university was absolutely dominated by the left, dominated by them. In fact, Enoch Powell was come due to speak at the university just as a guest. And they painted all over the university, smash Enoch Powell, smash him. And that was allowed to start painted all over the place. I was outraged. And I was a bit of a right winger in those days, but not a nationalist. So I was still sort of trying to work it all out in my mind. Anyway, Enoch Powell's invitation was withdrawn. You know, the left with their slogan, Smash Powell, written or painted all over the university. They won. The university authorities withdrew the invitation to Enoch Powell, who was a member of parliament, who'd been a war hero for this country. Mm-hmm. A war hero. And an educated man, a professor. I was outraged, actually. Anyway, the paradox is, and life is very paradoxical, because of Enoch Powell's campaigning on the race issue, in spite of the fact that Powell gets thrown into the wilderness, come the next general election, the guy who, I should be correct here, the British politician, the Conservative leader, who had expelled Enoch Powell from the Tory party, played the race card in his time. Then comes a general election, right? Race is the issue. And the Tory leader of the day says, goes on to the television, addresses the British people and says, I will control immigration. And I will make the immigrants sign in at the police stations. Well, the only place they sign on, of course, is the labour, so the unemployment bureaus, where they get their benefits from for the next 50 years or whatever. But on the strength of this Tory prime minister, whose name happened to be Ted Heath, the British people voted him into power on the promise that he was going to stop immigration. Then there was a problem in East Asia. Some local African leader, Idi Amin by name, wanted the Asians out of East Asia. These Asians had no right to come to Britain. They were Indians. And strictly speaking, these Asian shopkeepers, whom the local Africans didn't want living in Uganda, East Africa, should have gone back to India. In fact, that would have been a benefit to India, I've no doubt about it. In that they had money, they had ability, they could speak English, tremendous plus points. In a third world, like, and some of them were doctors and lawyers. India would have benefited from having those Indians who'd lived under the British Raj for about, I don't know, a generation maybe. because that had all been part of our empire. But instead of them going back to India, which was their cultural roots, where they'd have been of use, Ted Heath, who'd won an just won an election on the promise, I'm going to stop immigration, let them into Britain. And that was in 1972. That was the last straw as far as I was concerned. So I joined the National Front. And I've been active in nationalism the last 40 years.
So how did you first hear about the National Front, and what appealed to you about them when you initially heard about
them? Okay, that's a very good question. That's a very good question. Because what appealed to me was, what appealed to me of them, I didn't want to join some bunch of old chaps, you know, raising their glasses to somebody or other in a back room at a pub. I wanted to be active. Because, right. because I'm an engineer and I've got a lot of energy, that's a fact. I want to be active. And what impressed me about the National Front, how I come to hear about them, was because of this enormous uproar that Ted Heath, this Tory politician, had just won a general election in 1970 on the promise, we will stop immigration. And then, without any good reason whatsoever, lets these Asians into Britain. The country was an uproar. He had reneged on his promises. And the National Front, which I knew very vaguely of, there was a parliamentary, we have parliamentary by-elections over here. The MP drops dead, they have to fill his place. There was a parliamentary by-election in West London, in Uxbridge, and the NF campaigned, and they got a tremendous vote. They didn't win the thing, of course. They got a tremendous vote. In addition, what alerted me to this National Front success in the autumn of 1972, hard on the heels of Ted Heath breaking every election promise that mattered at all, was that... The BBC, the British Broadcasting Corporation, which I have hated for decades, and which I'd hated for years in 1972, because the BBC, even without any political knowledge or experience, I could see the BBC was always against us British, always against us, always for the foreigners, always for anybody who was non-British and anti-British. I knew that in 72. And now the BBC used to have a weekly magazine. And on the front cover, well, in the, you know that you can go into these WH and Smiths, and there's the news stalls, aren't there?
Yeah.
And there's all the front covers of the magazines, right? You see, you know, that's an interesting magazine, I'll buy that. Well, there on the front cover of the BBC magazine was a photograph. This is hard on the heels of the National Front, hard on the heels of this National Front success, doing very, very well in this by-election. They didn't win the by-election, but they got a staggeringly high vote. Directly on the basis that the Tories, the Conservatives, had reneged on their promises about immigration. Remember, this election had taken place in West London, Uxbridge, which is very close to London Airport, where all these Asians were flying in, yeah? With all their turbans and all their kids and all their women in saris are utterly alien to us. Freezing cold, they come in the middle of winter. I thought they'd come to hell or something, I'd have thought. Anyway, they come to Magic Land where they get everything for nothing, of course. Anyway, on the front cover of the BBC magazine was a photograph of a man I was to get to know very well. The photograph was of John Tyndall. Now, I hadn't actually heard of John Tyndall at that point, but I realised with one glance, as one does, that the BBC hated the chairman of the National Front. And since I, in my turn, hated the BBC, I thought perhaps me and this John Tyndall have got something in common. And indeed we did. Anyway, if you like, I'll talk a bit about the National Front, yeah?
Yes, please. And I'm really interested in John Tyndall. I never had a chance to meet him. I heard audio of him speaking, and I always thought he was a really impressive person.
He was indeed. In fact, I've got some material here. And whilst I'm talking, you can look at that's the last issue that was ever produced. So, there was John Tyndall on the front page of the BBC magazine, and I very, very quickly joined the National Front because I liked the way they were active. They had the right idea. They weren't content to sit in the back room of a pub talking about this chap or that chap or some other chap from yesteryear. They wanted to go to the people. They had marches down Oxford High Street, the Union Jacks flying, bunting, loudspeakers, vote National Front. And they knew, they took the people by storm in Uxbridge, and I wanted to be part of that. So I was in the NF all through the 70s, and I would say here, there were two men who made the National Front. Two men. One of them was John Tyndall, who was the chairman. Tyndall was an idealist. He devoted himself. He had tremendous energy, Tyndall, tremendous energy, tremendous ability, and tremendous courage. And they're actually the three virtues, in my opinion. Courage, intelligence, and energy. That's what makes a good nationalist. Anyway, Tindal was one, and the other man I think you met the other evening was Martin Webster. They were those two men who, for reasons of personality, didn't like each other very much. But that's no concern of mine. I couldn't care less who likes whom in this business. It means I'm totally immaterial. But those two men made the National Front. The technique was to go to the people. They had us standing in our local high streets selling our papers and all that sort of thing. We used to march around every major city in Britain, the Union Jacks flying. Mm-hmm. And what I noticed, so it was great. The activism was great to get in amongst ordinary people and say, look, vote National Front. Don't vote for these creeps of Tories and Labourites. They're all traitors, the whole lot of them. To go up to ordinary people and tell them that. I can tell you a bit more about campaigning, if you like. But also, one had a tremendous political experience, because not only was one active, but one learnt after a short time. You know, the National Front was quite a small party, really. You know, there were several hundred of us, perhaps 2,000 activists across the United Kingdom, working practically 24/7. We all had jobs. I had a good job at the time. I must say, talking to you North Americans, I'm not going to say what firm I work for, because they're very good to me, but and I'm talking about the 80s, really. My firm was very, indulgent to me, or understanding. They knew all about me. Very. Partly because the men who ran the firm, this is the paradox of life, the men who ran the firm, and some of the women, were Second World War generation. Now that, they had a good understanding, and of course they're all Enoch Powell supporters, of course. But I was in the National Front, I wasn't in the Tory party. And I hadn't been in the National Front very long, maybe a year or two, when I realised, and we can talk about this a bit later, the tremendous opposition there was from the British establishment. When I say the British establishment, I just don't mean the Tory party. I don't just don't mean the Liberal Party or the Socialist Labour Party. I mean the Church of England. I mean the Communist Party. I mean the Jewish Board of Deputies. The whole lot, including the Church of England, I think I said them, were utterly and completely against us. And that came as a sort of, and the BBC. Now, I'd already learned to hate, and I'll use that word, hate the BBC, because they never had a good word for us British people, never. But I didn't realise it went so far as to all these other establishment pillars. And anyway, that's one of my lessons, and that's one of my experiences, and I drew certain conclusions from that, which we can talk about a bit later if you like. Anyway, then that was all through the 70s, because I've been in this business 40 years. And if you ask me why I'm in it, I would say, really, I'm in it because I find it so interesting. I do find it interesting. And one does meet some amazing people in this business. One meets amazing people. And also, one learns some amazing things. I think, actually, I'm going off a tangent here, and you may not understand this, but I think if you was British working class and you wanted an understanding of politics at one time, you'd have joined the Communist Party, I think, before the Second World War. Because that was leaving the sort of Jewish element of the Communist Party to one side. There were working class people who got a political education in the Communist Party because they could see even then, before the Second World War, there was something wrong with the British establishment. They weren't necessarily endorsing the Soviet Union or didn't even know some of the things that Joe Stalin was getting up to, and they wouldn't have known the ultimate purpose. But certainly coming back to here, ordinary people who joined the National Front had a tremendous political education if you managed to survive all the rough and tumble. Anyway, I was in the front throughout the 70s. Come 79, the establishment brought out one of their confidence tricksters. You may have heard of her.
Yes.
Margaret Thatcher. Now, she went on the television. But before she did so, they went to work on her. They had a BBC producer, and they sort of blonded up her hair somewhat, straightened out her buck teeth, and most important of all, taught her to lower her voice a whole octave so that she came over as caring. And she went on the television, famous, because by then the front was taking Britain by storm, particularly the British working class, particularly these big cities, London, Birmingham, Manchester, parts of South Wales, parts of Scotland. And she went on the television, classic performance, in one phrase, she annihilated the National Front in one phrase and got herself, because by that time she was the leader of the opposition, the socialists were in power. She wanted to get back into number 10 Downing Street. So she went on the box and said, we conservatives, we conservatives understand the fears of the British people of being swamped by alien cultures. She knew exactly how to do it. I don't know how many times she had to practice saying that. But she did it, that one phrase did it. Bang, bingo. It was like as if the earth moved beneath our feet. Whereas up to then, I used to work with these very decent women, actually, in this huge office. And they said to me, Richard, we don't need your little party anymore. We got Maggie Thatcher. I just said, well, I think, ladies, that you'll find you're mistaken. Something like that. After I was working with these women, I couldn't sort of get too heavy with them. Anyway, so the front was effectively destroyed because these parties to an extent need success, and when that circle of success is broken, it becomes very, very difficult. It can be restarted again, but you have to have a strong constitution to start a nationalist party once it's destroyed. So the effect was Margaret Thatcher took all our votes away. We tried to warn people, but, you know, your little party was interested in your little opinion, as these women said to me, quite frankly and candidly. They all voted Tory, of course. Understandably, from one point of view. Anyway, the fact is, the front was effectively destroyed, yeah? Now, one man saved the situation. John Tyndall.
Mm-hmm.
He came along, the front was destroyed, and he set up the British National Party. He read us that very famous... He called us all together in a hotel not far... hotel in central London, and he read that famous poem by Rudyard Kipling.
Yes.
You know, if you can worn out tools, bend down when people call you, all the, you know, twist your words against you and fools believe it and all that. He read that out to us because obviously that was deep to him, and he said, I'm going to form a new party. The National Front is dead, long live the British National Party. And so we formed the British National Party, and it took us a very, very long time, but eventually we got the thing going again. And I will say of the British National Party, I can say a number of things about it, but let us get this fact right. A party that effectively, a movement which started from nothing. I've mentioned the two men in the 1970s, yes, who made the National Front.
Right.
And John Tyndall formed and made the British National Party, yeah? You're talking about two men there, and other people like myself. Nobody with any money. Just I did this, if you like. Anyway, cut a long story short, I just want to stress what a success the British National Party was at one stage. Just, what's it now, 15 now? Just 6 years ago, in 2009, the British National Party, 1 million people voted for the British National Party in the Euro elections of 2009, yeah? Well, given that only about 20 million people, after all, Britain's much smaller than the United States of America, yeah? Given about 20 million people voted in that elections, we're talking about the elections of the European Parliament of 2009,
mm-hmm.
that 1 million voted British National Party, that's 5% of the whole population, of those who chose to vote, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Now, that is a success. This is a party run by people, effectively without anything but their own convictions, energy, courage and intelligence. We got 1 million people voted for us in 2009. The following year, there was a general election, which coincided with local government elections over here. The British National Party organised and fielded 1,000 candidates. Now, that is a tremendous effort. It takes a lot of work to be one candidate. I'm a candidate myself in this current general election. It takes a lot of work and quite a bit of money as well. But the British National Party fielded 1,000 candidates. That's 1,000 brave men and women. Photographed, name, because your name goes outside the town hall, yeah?
Yeah.
It's completely public. You're running for public office. You're a public figure. You appear in the local papers, which may be neutral, and a photograph, a little bit of a statement, or it might be a real hatchet job, calling you a Nazi. We have all these insults thrown our way. You know, the finer patriot you are, the more abuse you get from trash and traitors, also known as the press and professional politicians. Yes, trash and traitors, professional mm-hmm. politicians, also known as. So, and in that general election of 2010, the British National Party printed and distributed 27 million leaflets. That's a tremendous task. We found the printers who were brave enough and decent enough. Because if you've got a print firm printing millions of leaflets of the British National Party, all the other printers know about it. You can't do that in quiet. But there were patriotic printers prepared to print millions of leaflets. Then they were shipped up and down the country. And it's one of the features of British politics that the post office delivers your leaflets for nothing. They do it. course, it's not delivered 100% perfect, but the leaflets, by and large, go out. It's part and parcel of standing as a parliamentary candidate. Mm-hmm. The post office delivers your election leaflets.
Right.
One to every household. So we got 27 million leaflets printed, and the post office more or less, delivered 27 million leaflets. That was done by a party which is motivated really by willpower. We raised the money to pay for the leaflets, to pay for the printers, and that was that. Unfortunately, there's always snags in this world. Every Garden of Eden has a snake. Every jar of ointment, they say, has got a fly in it, whatever. So the British Natural Party then had some certain problems, which we can talk about if you like, but I won't make it personal.
Talk about some of the problems. Because 2009 to 2015 is not a long period of time, and the party has declined to almost nothing.
That's right.
That's an interesting story. We need to hear that story. We need to hear the downs and the ups.
You're bracing yourselves, are you, gentlemen?
Yes.
Got your safety belts on.
Yeah.
As what was that famous film Bette Davis was in, maybe before the Second World War, about a plane going through an electric storm.
Yeah.
She says, tighten your safety belts. We're in for a bumpy ride.
Yeah.
It's a famous scene out of one of these films.
Yeah.
Bette Davis. Anyway, how do I come to know about her? Anyway, yes, you want to hear that the downside. Yeah, it's not always up. Anyway, listen, let me put it this way. There's the movement and there's the parties, right?
Right.
There's the movement and there's the parties. Yesterday afternoon, you saw some of the movement, yeah?
Right.
Really enjoyable meeting, yes?
Yes.
Yeah, really enjoyable. So that's the movement. And I have no doubt that the movement will succeed. I have no doubt that the white man will sort his problems out. White men, born of white women, all that, they're going to sort these problems out. I have no doubt. I couldn't do this if I didn't know that we are going to solve these problems. You know, you've only got to look at the past, for goodness sake. The European race had all sorts of ups and downs. This country, over 1,000, was subject to the Viking raids. They were diabolical raids and Viking raids. Well, how nationalists can admire the Vikings, I do not know. They were bloody slavers. You know what they did, the Vikings?
Yeah.
Dreadful people. Dreadful to this country. Anyway, we survived that. We survived the Black Death. You know, 1/3 of the population of Europe, including England, Britain, died of the Black Death. So I have no doubt that we can overcome these. Look, we have certain problems with politician trash, traitor trash, and those to whom they may answer, yes. But, so I know that we can beat all these. I have no doubt whatsoever. Anyway, back to the problems of the British National Party. Unfortunately, as I said, there's the movement and there's the parties. The parties are all too human, of course. I've said that the National Front was made by Martin Webster and John Tyndall. I think if you were to ask Martin himself, or I think you met the other day, he would confirm what I would say, that there wasn't much love lost between John Tyndall and Martin Webster. Tyndall was the idealist, the driving force. But Martin, he was the man who made it all happen. Martin Webster, remarkable man. He's not in the best of health now, but 40 years ago, very strong man. And very brave and very quick-witted. And I've seen him so quick-witted with journalists, so quick-witted. Very clever man, Martin Webster. An ideal man to go on the streets and to lead the troops. Well, Tyndall was a very brave man. Led us into many difficult situations. Kept the troops together. We came out with flags flying. But, yes, the movement is all too human. And unfortunately, unfortunately, there was a great deal of maladministration at the top of the British National Party, and some of the most effective people, if not all the effective people, were effectively expelled from the British National Party by a chap who was the chairman, who I think had a sort of paranoia. The man who was running the British National Party in the year 2000, had a sort of paranoia. Let me put it this way. I'll come back to that in a second.
Okay.
It's not an easy subject to talk about, but I will just tell you this, just in case you don't know. John Tyndall built the British National Party up, yeah, from nothing. Mm-hmm. In 1999, he was challenged by Nick Griffin, yes?
Mm-hmm.
Nick Griffin had been in nationalism ever since he was an 18-year-old, a 19-year-old at Cambridge University. Yeah? Nick Griffin has abilities. Nick Griffin, when he was chairman of the British National Party, did the BNP a lot of good, because Nick Griffin is no fool. He knows his nationalism, and he also led from the front, and he did the British National Party a lot of good, yes? Yeah? However, there is most certainly a however in all of this. Yeah. When Nick Griffin challenged John Tyndall in 1999, we're discussing the history of the British National Party here. When Nick Griffin challenged John Tyndall in the year of 1999, and when the majority of our members voted to sack John Tyndall as chairman and replace him by Nick Griffin, I personally was so angry with our members, because it was quite clear to me that our members, in their majority, Griffin got 60% of the vote, Tyndall got 40% of the vote. I was so angry with our members for voting in the guy who shouldn't have been chairman, which is Nick Griffin, that I left Britain and lived in Russia for 3 years. I couldn't bear to live in Britain, not a Britain which had Nick Griffin as the chairman of the British National Party. Having said all that and declared my state in all this, there's no doubt that Nick Griffin in the years of the 2000s, the party was very successful. It was under Nick Griffin's chairmanship that the BNP got 1 million votes. It was under Nick Griffin's chairmanship that the BNP put up 1,000 candidates in the year 2010. But the question arises with regard to Nick Griffin's chairmanship of the British National Party, which actually I'm only talking about rather reluctantly, but the facts are well known over here, and since you want to know the facts, I'll tell you the facts. It's very debatable quite who was responsible for the rise in the British National Party in the years of the 2000s, yeah? Obviously, Nick Griffin as chairman took the credit for it. And I'll say Nick Griffin is a brave man, because there are plenty of leftists who would like to have hurt Nick Griffin, hurt him seriously, as chairman of the British National Party. But they were on the ground. We had some wonderful, wonderful, wonderful brave men and women who, in their own towns, small towns, stood head and shoulders and stood up for the British National Party and got no thanks for it, were put in prison sometimes for it, for standing up the British National Party. Brave men and women. To campaign as a nationalist when you're being attacked verbally by the press and all the rest of it, it takes great character and great courage. And to what extent the success of the British National Party was down to these individuals, I can mention some of the names, Steve Smith there was a man called Steve Smith in Burnley, Lancashire. He worked as a local accountant. Now, Burnley's a medium-sized town. And every morning, from 7 in the morning till 9 in the morning, he'd walk up and down his high street on his own with a placard front and back saying, "Vote British National Party." Now, that's not easy in a town with a lot of Pakistanis, mm-hmm. in a town with a lot of communists, in a town where he ran a business as an accountant. And to do it, you can do a lot of things if you've got two of you. You do it on your own. That is a very difficult thing to do on your own. He was stopped by the police, threatened with arrest by the police, just walking up and down his town where he was a local organiser, well known. There's one man, I can mention a woman called Marlene Guest in Rotherham, who for years campaigned about the fact that the police and the establishment, the local council, were deliberately turning a blind eye to gangs of Pakistani criminals sexually abusing underage English girls, which is now notorious. But the authorities denied that this crime was taking place. Marlene Guest, for year after year after year, campaigned in her town, Rotherham, as a BNP councillor, the only BNP councillor on her town hall. Now, they're tremendously courageous people. Now, to what extent the rise of the British National Party was due to the Steve Smiths of Burnley and the Marlene Guests of Rotherham, and hundreds of others, of course, and to what extent it was the rise of Nick Griffin, you can spend 1 million years working it all out. All I'm saying is that, unfortunately, due to serious malaise, due to the chairman whose name I'll refer to, and I've said he's a brave man with abilities, Nick Griffin's no fool, Oxford, a Cambridge graduate, etc. He just expelled so many. I think, was it not Henry Bolingbroke who arranged for the death of Richard II? and thereafter used to have nightmares when he was King Henry IV. Do you know about English kings, by the way? I know you come from North America, you two, but do you know about English kings?
It's sort of our history.
Sort of your history, right. Yeah. Oh, of course, you are sort of branch off from us, aren't you? Yeah, of course you are. That North American colony who rose up against our King George III, declared themselves independent in 1776. It's, you know, you read Henry IV, he had nightmares, didn't he? Because he'd arranged for the previous king to be murdered.
Yeah.
Or put to death, Richard II in York, somewhere in York Castle. And of course, after that, he's, you know, is it going to happen to me? And I think that Nick Griffin suffered one back. Because the fact is, Nick Griffin owed everything to John Tyndall. Mm-hmm. Everything. You know, Griffin was a nothing. He hadn't got a job or anything. Starts writing letters to John Tyndall. Let us in, John, you'll find me a useful and loyal lieutenant. Mm-hmm. Well, there you are. What can I say? You've got to be careful in this business. But as I said, there's party and there's movement. The movement continues. You have to factor in the human element. Every one of us. You know, it's the basic teaching of Christianity is that we're all fallen creatures.
Mm-hmm.
Garden of Eden and all that. When Eve said to Adam, go on, Adam, eat this apple I'm offering you. His parents were chucked out of the Garden of Eden. Anyway, so we're fallen creatures. You have to allow for the human factor. And John Tyndall, when the National Front fell to bits after Maggie Thatcher took everything away from us, he founded the British National Party. I have no doubt that nationalism will resurrect itself out of the wreck of the British National Party, which, by the way, what a wreck. In 2010, the British National Party put up 350 parliamentary candidates. I think 5 years later, I think they're putting up 8 candidates. You know, God help us. God help us. But small beer, life continues. Life always continues. And of course it will, there's no doubt about it. Anyway, that's that, right? Yeah.
You said you're standing for Parliament. What party is that in?
I'm the National Front. I've gone back to the National Front. Because I think it's a wonderful name.
Oh, yeah, it's a great name. Who's revived the National Front?
It's revived itself, sir. Revived itself. You've heard of the spontaneous coming together of life, eh?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, the National Front has always existed. These parties, you know, you get 2 or 3 score and keep a party going.
Yeah.
And there's always, you know, and no doubt there'll people keep the British National Party going, you know, just how it is. Little clubs, like little political clubs.
Right.
And since the name existed, I contacted the man who was the chairman, who I happen to know. I said, I'd like to rejoin him. He said, oh, pleased to have you back, Richard. And that was about 3 years ago when I stayed in the British National Party hoping, in spite of my, look, whatever I thought of Nick Griffin is just a private thing to me. The British National Party was so successful, one doesn't rock the boat. The fact that me and Griffin don't get on, what, that's small beer, who cares about that? John Tyndall and Martin Webster didn't get on, who cares about that? But when the British National Party fell to bits, I thought, well, now I'll leave the BMA. Because always, even living in Russia, I renewed my subs every year.
Mm-hmm.
Living in the muddy wastes of Russia. We can talk about Russia if you like.
Yeah, I'd like to talk about that. What are some of the other nationalist parties that are on the current scene now, besides the National Front and the BNP?
Are you sitting comfortably?
Yes.
How long is the list? What do you want to hear?
Well, let's just talk about the ones you think might be contenders that have attracted good people or have good ideas.
Well, there's a very fine man called Andrew Bronze. Very fine man, who's been in this even longer than me. I joined the National Front when I was 30. I think a certain political philosopher advised people not to join politics until they were 30.
That's true.
That is true. So I got that right. I thought I might have got that right. Anyway, Bronze, perhaps he hadn't read this man's book. Anyway, he joined at 16. Andrew Bronze, a very fine man. Very, very fine man. He was for years and years and years a lecturer of politics and law at a college in Yorkshire, doubling up as a National Front, leading National Front member in the 1970s, as chairman of the National Front in the 1980s, and recent, you know, That takes a bit of skill to combine a prestigious middle-class job as a college lecturer in politics and law whilst being the chairman of the National Front. Now, that takes some doing. But he did it, because have you ever met Andrew Bronson?
No, I'd like to meet him.
You should try to do so. He's a very fine individual. And to cut a long story, he was one of those who, in 2009, when a million people voted British National Party at the Euro elections of 2009, we got two candidates elected. One was Nick Griffin, and the other was Andrew Bronson. And then, when the British National Party fell to bits, Andrew Bronson has now formed a sort of, you might call it a skeleton party, little more than a name, called the British Democratic Party. But they've got people up and down the country. And Andrew Bronson's a very fine man, very fine man. But I'm in the National Front because A, I like the name. B, I like the history. C, I like the men and women who founded it. I could talk about the National Front if you like.
Yeah, please do.
And I like the success of the National Front in the 1970s. And I repeat, the National Front has got a nationwide organisation. It's not very big, but it's got a nationwide. It's important. We have candidates standing in Scotland, in Wales, and in England. And so, I like the name, and I like the people in it. So I'll tell you who founded the National Front. Do you want to hear about
that? Yeah, please do.
The National Front has been around for a very long time, almost 50 years. The National Front, interestingly enough, was founded before Enoch Powell made his speech on the 20th of April, 1968. Now, the year is very important, 1968. The rest of it is pure coincidence.
Right.
But in 1968, he made his speech, yeah? But a year or so before, the National Front had been founded by British patriots. If I'd known this was going to come up, I'd have brought their names along. But One had been an admiral of the Royal Navy, Admiral Sir Barry Donville. Mm-hmm. Another had been an air commodore. Two had been British generals. At least one woman had been an Oxford scholar. Now, when the name National Front comes up, you think of, these working class lads,
Right.
Battling on a high street, flying the Union Jack flag. People have no idea who founded the National Front. It was founded by, I repeat, an admiral of the Royal Navy, mm-hmm. an air commodore, two British generals, and a number of Oxford scholars, and a British reverend of mm-hmm. the Church of England, I should imagine. These were top middle class people, who could see that Britain was going completely off the rails, completely. And they founded the National Front, unknown to most people, of course, before Powell spoke, but they were driven by the same forces that caused Enoch Powell, who was not only a Tory MP, but a government minister. Powell had been a government minister, as well as a senior officer in the British Army. I think there's more to Powell than meets the eye, actually. But anyway, these men were driven by the same forces that caused Powell to speak out. And then the next key event in the history of the National Front was that John Tyndall and Martin Webster joined the National Front, and they decided to go to the British people, to go to the streets, go campaigning. So I will say of the breakup of the British National Party, it doesn't worry me in the least, personally. Not in the least. Of course, a lot of people are broken-hearted. When the National Front broke up, when Maggie Thatcher took all our votes and all our policies and went lying on the box, the National Front, 90% just disappeared. Collapsed within 12 months. 90%, 95% disappeared. All Tyndall needed was 5% to get the thing going again.
Right.
And you've got a lot more than 5% of the BNP existing now, because we've been through this once.
Right.
And it's all so much more obviously worse. Mm-hmm. Anyway, that's enough of that. What else do you want me to talk about?
Well, you already have addressed the fact that you're fundamentally optimistic, that you think this is going to...
Yeah, sure.
We're going to turn this all around. I think that's good to know. Do you have any questions?
Any contemporary ideas about the universities, or what you've been thinking about recently? What's exciting you?
What's exciting me? Blimey. I'm 72 years of age, sir.
I wouldn't guess it from their energy level.
Well, I'm just going along, really. Yeah. Let me tell you, let me answer your questions like this. I tell anybody who is at college to be very, very careful, not to declare their hand whatsoever. Not at all. I disapprove of people who try to form youth movements. I think it's totally wrong. I think young people should be allowed to lead their lives. I tell you, when I was at college, university, studying engineering, I had to discipline myself. to keep away from politics because I knew it had a fascination for it. I wanted to get my qualifications as an engineer. I wanted to get them. And I'd advise that to anybody, get your qualifications. There's plenty of time for the rest of it. But let me expand a bit, right? Because we've been very narrowly focused up to now. Let me expand a bit. I have said to you that I believe that the way to solve these problems is to go to the people, yeah? That's what attracted me to the National Front in 1970. Go to the people. Electioneering, if necessary, you know, march down a street, demonstrate with Union Jack flags and in a white area, yeah? Now, let me say this. I think these are questions that may be in your mind that have not yet even come up, so I'll anticipate your questions. You know, and I'll anticipate what the people listening to this will think. Here's the National Front, or the British National Party, whatever they call themselves nowadays. Fine patriots, standing up for Britain, standing up in defence of our identity, you know, against an obvious betrayal. Obvious. I just tell you one fact. 1/4 of the babies born across the whole of England and Wales are now born to mothers born overseas. 1/4. We're not talking about inner London or inner Birmingham. 1/4. The mothers born, the babies born in Britain, born in England and Wales. Scotland is a bit different, actually. But I live in England, I live in London. And England is the heart of this country, says an Englishman, right?
Right.
So, and Wales has been part of us for a very long time. 1/4 of all the babies born are born to mothers born in China, India, Pakistan, Iraq, Iran, South America, mm-hmm. the Caribbean. It's very, very dangerous. So the question, the obvious question is, why aren't millions flocking to join us?
Right.
Why aren't all these fine people, educated people? You know, we were founded by generals and admirals. Why aren't their contemporaries knocking on our door? And the answer is that the establishment is against us, just as we're against the establishment. There's no love lost. Mm-hmm. And the establishment has, as any establishment has, a great many carrots and a very large stick.
Right.
You want to keep your job. You don't want to appear in your local paper as, you know, denounced as the wickedest person since, whoever.
Yeah.
Whoever they've last denounced in this world. If you don't want that, then you stay away from all this. The next question arises is, how does a country come to get an establishment which is so obviously destroying its own people? Destroying its country. And you, what I'm talking about here, I'm talking about Britain, but I could equally be talking about France or Holland or Scandinavia or Italy or Spain or Germany. All these countries, Britain, France, etc., have governments which are clearly totally against the interests of their own people, yeah? Openly, blatantly.
Right.
So the question arises, how does such an establishment come to be in being? How does it come to be? And this is where, if you like, I get to my personal motivation. Because I am motivated, A, because of what I saw when I was a 16-year-old living in West London. The fact that suddenly these utter aliens were starting. If you go to where I was a child, you think you was in New Delhi. Go to Hounslow High Street, you think you was in New Delhi. Where I played as a boy. Now, a huge mosque there.
Mm-hmm.
You wouldn't want to be a British lad in that area, or a British girl. You wouldn't want to be. They look at you with contempt as an idiot. As an idiot. They look at you with contempt. You're an idiot. Who are you? Out the way. Well, you've given your country away.
Of course, they should have contempt for us.
Well, never mind that, sir. Never mind that. We'll discuss and debate that later. Yeah. They should be in their own countries, sir. That's... Sorting out their own countries.
Yeah.
I think you'll find I'm right, sir.
Yeah.
Okay. I used to be a school teacher, by the way. Just okay. But factor that in, sir. I used to be a school teacher. Okay. Anyway, where was I before I was interrupted? Yeah. How did we come to get such a wicked establishment? Yeah. And I said to you, now I'll get to my personal motivation. Partly what happened where I brought up as a child, which is what motivates most nationalists, yes? They see their areas destroyed. But I asked myself, how did we get such an anti-British establishment running Britain? And I will say, and this is my personal take on it, having given an enormous amount of thought, that we have been destroyed. We Europeans, we whites, destroyed ourselves in 2 world wars. And at the end of the Second World War in 1945, you can say, as I put on your website, Countercurrents, and you were kind enough to, you know, let it go through, that in 1945, Germany was destroyed, France was broken, and Britain was bankrupt.
Mm-hmm.
We, in 1945, we lived on American food coupons.
Right.
I remember as a child, we used to have these tins in our house, American dried egg powder. Mm-hmm. We lived on that because Britain was bankrupt in 1945. Bankrupt. A ruined nation.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so of course, the winners of the Second World War were, of course, the Soviet Union and the United States of America, or at least the people who run these two countries.
Right.
And of course, being the winners and deciding whether we would have food in our bellies or not, of course, they appointed their puppet politicians.
Mm-hmm.
Whether you're talking about, you know, communist prime ministers in Poland or Hungary, answerable to the Red Army, or whether you're talking about politicians in France or Holland or bankrupt Britain. And those politicians knew to sing the song that the Soviet Union and the United States sung in a chorus together. We won the war. The war was a great war. And anybody who disagreed that the Second World War was a good war, I think it was your Studs Turtle, if I may put the personal adjective "you're" in front of the word "your." I don't know whether you regard Studs Turtle as yours or not, but your the American Studs Turtle said, wrote a book called The Good War.
Right.
And that is more or less, in a next month, the British government, the British establishment is going to celebrate the victory in the Good War, yeah?
Right.
Now, anybody from 1945 onwards who questioned that war, who said that Second World War was a wicked waste of good men's lives, on top of the First World War. Remember, they're only 20 years apart.
Yeah.
Just, it's incredible. When you reach a certain age, 20 years is nothing. I assure you, when you reach a certain age, it's absolutely nothing. I'm talking about Maggie Thatcher. It's nearly 40 years ago, Maggie Thatcher.
Yeah.
And yet that's in my mind. And millions of British... So anyway, a million British soldiers were killed in the First World War. A million. That's fit young men. Idealistic and patriotic. Yeah. Marched off for king and country. Killed. No one can tell you what that was about. No one's ever given a justification for that war. 20 years later, the British government, and of course it was the British government in August 14,
mm-hmm.
and in September 39, which declared war on Germany. Most people probably think it's the other way around. It was the British government declared war on both occasions.
Yeah.
So anybody in 1945 who said, what was all that about? That was an even more wicked waste of good men's lives, would be blackened with the same propaganda as the defeated Germans. And I'm saying here that the result of the Second World War was to establish a new political order, worldwide actually, as represented by the United Nations, whereby the Second World War was a good war, the utterly wicked guys lost, utterly wicked guys and their friends lost, and the good guys won. And, you know, what the sort of thing that made me think, so you've got an establishment that owes everything to the victory of the Soviet Union and the United States of America. I'll expand upon that. The parties in power who rule Britain now, the Conservative Party, the Liberal Party, and the Socialist Labour Party, they were the parties that launched the two world wars. It was the Liberal Party in power who launched, who declared war on Germany in August 1914. Herbert Asquith was the Liberal Prime Minister of Britain who declared war on Germany in 1914. Never gave an explanation why he did it. And it was the Conservative government in September 39 who declared war against Germany again. And Churchill's government was a coalition government, Tory, Labour and Liberal. So the parties that run Britain now are the direct heirs of those who declared these world wars. So you have an establishment which has an absolute interest in anybody in maintaining the good war. And what alerted me to this was we had our little party, the National Front, and you know, we were saying Britain for the British, and then the communists, who were always the leading, in the 1970s and 80s, the communists were the voice of the British establishment. Paradoxical though that may seem. The communists would say, and that would be then repeated by the BBC, And then it would filter into the Guardian newspaper and then into the Times. But that was usually the concatenation of opinions. Communists, BBC, Guardian newspaper, left liberal, then the Times, claimingly neutral, and then the so-called right-wing conservative Daily Telegraph. And they would say to us, "You National Fronters, we fought a world war against you. We fought a world war against you." And we were absolutely puzzled. You know, we're British patriots. My father served in the war. My mother's brother was killed. And then it became clear because of a certain parallel. Here were we standing up for British identity and the protection of Britain's boundaries and keeping Britain British. Mm-hmm. And of course, one can say that a world war was declared in 1939 against one European country, which indeed wanted to maintain its identity and maintain its frontiers. And so, what I'm saying is that the British establishment, and I think this is a charge that should be made, because I'm British, you know, I speak as British. That is my first identity. Mm-hmm. I think the British establishment are liars and murderers. The two world wars are utterly unnecessary. We can talk about some of the British government's propaganda, if you like, because propaganda is very, very important in this, yeah? But I will say of the British establishment, they're liars and murderers. They murdered those men in two world wars. I think that charge should be made.
Mm-hmm.
They died for nothing. I partly get this from my parents, of course.
Right.
I'm very influenced by my parents. My father served in the Second World War. He could never see any sense in it. Saw no sense in it, particularly after my mother's brother was killed. And I told you, I was brought up as a child, mm-hmm. hearing my mother say, "What good, you spit her about it. She was close to her brother. What good did it?" And I tell you, when I was about 10, we're now talking 1953, right?
Mm-hmm.
I heard my mother, you know, you listen to, you're talking to your mother. She says a word. You say, "What's that word, Mum?" She used the word. She was attacking Churchill for the umpteenth time. Remember, we were Labour Party. You
know? Right.
She said, "Churchill's a warmonger." I'd never heard the word before. What's a warmonger?
Right.
A warmonger is somebody who loves war for its own sake. And I tell you, I don't know if you factored this into your understanding of European history, but Churchill was Britain's war leader in the Second World War, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
The first opportunity the British got in the summer of 45, they sacked him, didn't they?
Right.
They sacked him. And my parents would have been one of the minions who voted against him to get him out.
Right.
The first chance the British people had, they got rid of Churchill because they saw him as a warmonger.
Right.
So I would like to accuse the British establishment of being liars and murderers. We can talk about their lies in a minute. I'm not a Christian, you understand,
mm-hmm.
but I take religion seriously. And I will quote to you St. John chapter 8, verse 44. "You are like your father, the devil. Like him, you were liars and murderers from the first day." It's Jesus Christ actually speaking to the Pharisees.
Right.
Well, I would like Richard Edmonds, obviously I'm not Jesus, I'd like Richard Edmonds to say that to the people who run this country. "You are liars and murderers." And I will now say what I think the solution to all this is.
Please.
Because I couldn't do this if I didn't know the solution. You must have met a lot of people who say that to you.
But I want to know.
It wasn't, there was carrot and stick when Maggie Thatcher destroyed the National Front in the 1970s. It wasn't only that she offered the British people an easy option of stopping immigration, yeah. She used a big stick on us. They accused us of being Nazis, right?
Right.
They had it, they had all the photographs of Auschwitz and all this. And the slogan was, "The National Front is a Nazi front. If they come to power, they'll murder millions of people." I don't murder anybody. That made me interested in the Auschwitz allegation. Perhaps you don't want to talk about this at great length, but I have satisfied myself. I've been to Auschwitz. I'm an engineer. I like to look at things with my own eyes. Mm-hmm. Shortly after the Berlin Wall came down, I organised a group of us. We went all around Eastern Europe. Fascinating trip. Some German nationalist I know had one of those little VW minibuses. Went all around Eastern Europe. Fascinating, including we stopped off and spent a day in Auschwitz, as one does, you know. Did the tourist thing at Auschwitz. Anyway, I wanted to see Auschwitz my own eyes. You know, I've satisfied myself that that is an allegation without any substance whatsoever. just a propaganda lie. You may know that in the First World War, how did the British wicked government induce the Americans to go and pull the chestnuts of the British Empire out the fire, as Pat Buchanan so prettily puts it? How'd they get all them GIs over there in Flanders, eh?
Right.
Trampling through the mud, eh? What was it, half a million boots trampling through the mud? That song of yours, you know. Buddy, can you spare a dime? Do you know the words of that?
Right.
Buddy, can you spare a dime? 500,000 boots tramping. I was the boy with a drum.
Yeah.
How did the wicked British government get them GIs over there? By atrocity propaganda, yeah?
Right.
All these wicked lies that the Germans are cutting kids' hands off. Mm-hmm. The British government had to apologise for that after the First World War. You know that?
Right.
You know the British government officially apologised to the German army and German people for telling them wicked lies, yes?
I didn't know they apologised.
They did.
That's very decent of them.
No, they wasn't decent at all. They were totally indecent. Totally indecent. Who obliged these liars at Westminster to speak the truth? Speak the truth and shame the devil. They are the devil. Who obliged them to do it? Well, I'm looking at some of you now. American journalists.
Right.
American journalists who were American firsters, who knew that the British government had tricked the American people into fighting that war for them. They went to Belgium looking for little kiddies with no hands. Surprise, surprise. They didn't find any little Belgian children miners at hands. And they published it. What was it? You had that Colonel Chicago Tribune, was it?
I don't know the details.
Yeah. Forgotten his name. Colonel, famous guy. Anyway, he was an American firster. He put it on his newspaper. It's all lies, British government lies. So the British government had to apologise. Had to formally apologise to the German army and German nation in 1922 in the House of Commons. And a leading British diplomat called Harold Nicholson, who'd helped draw up the Versailles Treaty, said, "I hope the British government never tells lies again. We lost enormous credibility." Well, I happen to satisfy myself that the allegation that the Germans murdered millions of Jews, the alleged Holocaust, has got nothing to substantiate it. I'm not minimising the suffering of the Second World War. Jews and Gentiles alike suffered appallingly. There were 60 million people killed in the Second World War.
Right.
Some of them were Jews, of course. They suffered appallingly, particularly those in Central Europe. But the allegation of the 6 million is just an allegation. And in my opinion, the slogan, "That was the good war," goes entirely back to the allegation that Hitler was mad, murdered millions of Jews, wanted to murder everybody else. In my opinion, just my opinion, I might be wrong here, that if that was to be revealed to be a lie, I think that this whole establishment would collapse. Just as in Eastern Europe, when everybody knew that communism was a lie. Just a lie.
Right.
The Soviet Union and the power base that it had just collapsed quite quickly and bloodlessly, thanks to Gorbachev. One has to say bloodlessly. I hope that something similar happens here. And that is my belief and that is my motivation that I think, and that is why I'd like to accuse the British government of being liars and murderers.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to quote that St. John chapter 8, if I ever bump into any of them.
Right.
Should that happen?
Should they return your phone calls? Right?
Should they return my phone and ask my opinion on anything?
Yes.
Exactly. Okay. Nice talking to you, Greg.
Well, Richard, thank you very, very much. There's a lot to digest here and a lot of very good, wise advice. So I hope this is just the first of many conversations.
Be good, yeah. Be good, yeah.